Hello and welcome to another episode of The Grey NATO, a Hodinkee podcast. It's a loose discussion of travel, diving, driving, gear, and most certainly watches. This is episode 99, and we thank you for listening. This episode is proudly brought to you by Alps and Meters. It's a skiing-heavy episode, so why not bring in a great apparel brand that connects nicely with skiing both on and off the mountain? Well, here we are, face-to-face in Colorado.
Face-to-face, this is one of the few episodes of the year, like people who listen know that this will be the third time that we've done the Oris kind of winter preview or spring. I don't know what you call it, New Year preview.
Yeah, right.
So and they do this in Colorado, and it's basically a press trip. There's a bunch of other, like all of the normal watch folk that you follow on Instagram are here, and it's one of maybe probably three times a year that we're face-to-face. You know, the Braemont one we do occasionally, and then...
The odd New York meetup.
New York one and the odd, like, Basel.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
But this is one where, like, there's legitimately, like, time in the schedule that works perfectly. We see some watches. Like, we ski in the morning, right, which is super fun. And I don't ski a ton, but it's a nice day out.
Yeah.
And we've now lucked out 2 years in a row with some of the most incredible weather. And what a gorgeous state, and Vail's fantastic. And then we get to go to lunch, and you get to see some watches, some that we can talk about, some that we can't. And then we basically go right from there back to my hotel room in this case, and we're sitting near a fire. And yeah, we've got a couple microphones, so let's do episode. We're almost at episode 100.
Yeah, I know. Jeez, what a milestone, man! Yeah. This is the last of the old century, I guess you'd call it. So yeah, onward.
So yeah, today was a pretty fun day. Like I said, so Jason and I don't do a ton of skiing. You a little bit more than me. I would say I'm ski capable.
I'm barely that. Yeah,
you know, I can ski. Yeah. I'm not a proficient skier. I'm not a talented skier. But I do absolutely relish the opportunity, especially in a scenario where it's combined with work. Yeah. So I kind of don't have any other reason to say, like, well, no, it's too expensive, or I don't have the time, or all these other things. So yeah, this is a nice way to get that day of skiing in a year.
Yeah. I feel like we don't have mountains in Minnesota. So I always feel like any skiing I do there early season is almost in preparation to come out here, because I'm a bit scared of just showing up here, you know, totally fresh. I guess you did, but, and skiing with Rolf Studer, who's the CEO of Oris and just an incredibly talented and accomplished skier. And then VJ Geronimo, the CEO of Oris North America, skied today with us. And that was a great chance. The past 2 years, he's kind of gone with the other non-skiing group of journalists that comes, and they do things like snowmobiling. And today they went snowshoeing. And but VJ, you know, he promised us one of these years he'd come skiing with us. And so he did all the runs with us, and it was
a solid day. I mean, incredible. It's big hills. Yeah. You and I are squarely, when it comes to Colorado Rockies, we're blue square folk.
Yes, exactly.
We dipped ever so briefly. It took longer than it should have, so briefly into the Black Diamond realm on an ungroomed piece in the back bowl. That rough. Really, really demanded the most of my patience and also my thigh strength.
So. Oh, my legs are burning. And I forgot to pack ibuprofen. I don't know if you have any, but man.
I do. Yeah, no. I always have painkillers. I'm for hurting. Sure. I got you.
Yeah, so, you know, we started out the day, kind of went up to the top, and, you know, it was a little chilly in the morning, and we headed up on the lift, all of us, with Barbara Palumbo and VJ and Rolf, and Matt Horonic was here.
Mm-hmm. Super fun to be able to, like, hang out with Matt.
Yeah, and so we went up on the first lift, got the first chair of the day, and went up and we did kind of a green run to kind of warm up a little bit, and then went right into some blue runs, and then, you know, Rolf, I think he lives by that credo that, you know, you'll never get better if you don't just try something that's a little beyond your abilities.
Sure. We went a little, like, it wasn't, like, maybe I think that's true if you go, like, 5%.
Yeah.
Towards the middle of the day when you're warmed up. And we were warmed up.
Sure.
It wasn't.
Yeah.
And, like, I wouldn't say it was terrible. It was just, like, beyond me.
Yes. Yeah, me too. Me too. I'll fully admit. So we got up, you keep going up and up and up, take various lifts and kind of work your way across the range here, and we got up to the top, and there's the famous back bowls of Vail, which for those that aren't familiar, you know, you kind of Vail's the town of Vail is sort of sits down at the bottom of the ski area, and the mountain sides that you see from the town are what they call the front side. And then once you get up to the top, if you crest over the top of those mountains and you go down the back of it, you get into what are called the back bowls, and it's like a big it's a big bowl of mountains.
You dip like back into a whole other valley. And yeah, for sure.
And most of that, or a lot of that, is ungroomed. There's a lot of trees, powder skiing, which people love. That's what people come here for. Of course, this was my first time skiing powder, and it was not groomed, and it was bumpy, and it was steep. I didn't see signs, but you know, we ducked under, don't tell anybody, but we ducked under a...
We were trying to make our way to what we thought was a blue square, and then we got about, like... I'm okay with steep if it's groomed.
Yeah.
Like, I think that run groomed would have been fine.
Sure. Yeah.
But it was the mix of steep and then it's light powder on top of like heavier stuff. So if you try and turn hard.
Yeah. Yeah.
My outside leg wouldn't always cooperate. So I bailed at least once, lost a ski, the whole, which is fine. Like, this is skiing.
Yeah. Right.
And if you're going to fall in powder.
I had no problem falling. I had no problem falling. I fell a
little bit more work
times.
To put everything back together.
Yeah, exactly. After you lose your ski in about 6 feet of snow below you. But it was fun. And Rolf and VJ, you went on ahead a little bit, and Matt went way on ahead.
Yeah. I tried to follow Matt, and then Matt kept going after my fall, and then I thought I was following him, and then it turned out I was on like a double black diamond that just had like all these big drops on it.
Oh man.
So then I kind of moved a different direction over to some moguls and weaseled my way down to a groomed piece. So.
Yeah, and I had the twin chaperones. I had Rolf in front of me showing me where to do my turns, and VJ behind me to help pick up the yard sale when I would crash. And so we made it down, and then by that time, I mean, it's murder on the thighs when you're, especially when you're not very good. But then we got back and came down to Vail Village in time for lunch. And, you know, my legs are tired, but boy, what a great day. The weather was beautiful.
It feels incredible just to get outside and have some exercise. I've been working out in front of a computer screen for what feels like a while now with the bike and everything else. And I was happy to see that I hadn't lost as much edge as I thought I had. You know, I went the whole day, and it was really only the last lap that we did that didn't feel great, where I was just kind of too tired to be really aggressive.
Oh yeah.
And I just kind of had to chill my way all the way down and that's fine. That's how you end a day, which is perfect. Right. But it was beautiful weather. It was cold, but like perfectly cold, like where you want it to be, where there's not wind that's like destroying your face or making it impossible for you to see. Or it was nice and sunny, great
blue sky,
for photos.
You get that crystalline, you know, sort of snow drifting off the trees that kind of glitters in the sun. And
absolutely.
Yeah, so we're staying at a Marriott here in Lion's Head, which is kind of the west side of everything in Vail. And but you know, we set out from the ski shop with our rental gear and head right up the chair to the mountain, and it's great. And I actually have to kind of credit Oris with getting me back into downhill skiing. I downhill skied a couple of times way back in high school, way in the Pleistocene era. But then when I had a bit of a knee injury playing football, I gave up downhill skiing for 30 years, and then this trip 3 years ago is what got me back into it. And it's one of those sports that it's intimidating. You know, it can be intimidating. There's definitely a technical and a gear aspect to it, and a fitness to a certain degree, especially here.
For sure.
But boy, it's a blast. It's fun. It's exhilarating. It's, you know, I do a lot of cross country skiing, and it's, you know, which is great fun. But you know, downhill, you get that little rush, you get that bit of speed, and when you're in the groove, and then actually when we got out of the back bowl, and that tricky bit, we were back on the groomed blue, and I was like, oh, I was
having a blast.
I feel confident now. You know, my legs were toast, but you know, I was kind of feeling some newfound confidence on that. So,
for me, I skied a bunch when I was a kid. We used to do the school trips, and once we got a certain level of proficiency, not even just skiing, but like understanding how to do rentals and everything that was enough of a lessening of the barrier for my dad to get back to skiing. He's a very talented skier.
Yeah.
And my brother won down for me. I have several siblings, but my brother won down for me. Grant is an insanely talented skier. Skied, represented with K2 for a while and you know, worked for that brand on the West Coast in Canada. And skiing with him, I always feel like I'm holding him back.
Oh yeah.
But when we were younger, we used to just go bomb all over Ontario, like wherever you could ski. And it was something I went from skis and then into, this'll make some statement for a few folks in the audience who are the same age as me, got into snowblades, which were a real thing when I was probably like maybe in high school, something like that. And then I kind of gave it up, move into university, you get kind of busy, then into work. And then I hit the West Coast and I skied a few times, and now this is kind of like, this is kind of the one outing. It's fun. You get to, you know, the people you're going to ski with, and it's an absolute blast. And it's a neat fit for Oris as well, because it's not a huge trip. There's not a ton of people here.
Right.
It's a relatively small crew, and it's a chance to like do something that connects with the brand, in this case, skiing and out kind of outdoor sporting adventure.
Yeah.
Sort of connection, but it's also very Swiss pastimes to ski and a big, both Vijay and role for very talented skiers, like we've mentioned, and it works really well that way. And then it's really only a couple hours that you're skiing, and then the rest of the day is looking at watches, recording TGNs, editing photos, and writing up pieces. And it's a bit of a hustle before dinner, and it's nice. It's a nice way to kind of start off the year with one of these trips that that really just kind of balances a little bit of exercise and some time outside with some cool watches, and certainly some really cool watches we saw just a couple hours ago.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny, at lunch I was talking to Rolf, and I said, you know what Oris needs to do is you need to do a kind of a ski associated watch, like a special edition ski watch of some sort. Take a Diver 65 and put a 12-hour bezel and make it kind of a travel ski watch or whatever. Because I associate Oris with skiing, and I think, you know, Oris kind of has this vibe too of, you know, you get brands like Longines is really into kind of ski partnerships, and they do a lot of the timing and Omega with the Olympics. But Oris is much more about kind of civilian enthusiast sports and things like that, you know? So I could see them like, you know, here we are in Vail, or they do a European journalist event in Zermatt. And, you know, I kind of associate that with them with that. Claudine, who's the co-CEO of Oris that you don't see, she's based over in Switzerland. But when I first did this trip, it was actually 4 years ago, and that was over in Zermatt before I was really even back into skiing. And she's quite a good skier. And then Rolf and Vijay. And I'm like, everybody in this company is a skier.
Yeah, it makes sense.
I like that. I like that about them. I like that there's a passion for that sport.
I agree. I mean, I think it's one of these things that ties nicely with the brand itself, but also the people behind it. Whenever we talk about Oris, and of course, Oris is a brand that has sponsored TGNs in the past, but it's a brand that we've connected with, you know, for many years, because they really own a price point. They own a really strong value proposition. They are, you know, an independently owned Swiss outfit that makes sporty steel watches that we really like. It's an easy thing to get into. And I think if you've held or seen any of their stuff in person, you would agree and understand why it's something that we enjoy that doesn't have to cost $10,000 or more or something like that. And and we'll certainly get into the watches, but I think before we get to that, it might be a decent time to talk about a different piece of kit for skiing, and we'll jump into an ad break for Alps and Meters.
Yeah. Yeah. So a few episodes back, Alps and Meters sponsored a couple of episodes, and we're thrilled to have them back. It's a great TGN brand. You know, they make this really cool mountain themed sort of, I would, vintage inspired ski apparel that it can also be worn off the mountain. They make you know, certain button up shirts and base layers and jackets and sweaters, lots of sweaters. But we recently tried out some new kit from them on this trip, actually today.
Yeah, so we knew we were going to go skiing, and I've had some experience, and we talked about this in previous ads for Alps and Meters, but we had some experience with their more casual stuff in the past, and you had skied in their pants before,
yeah,
like you did today. And I thought it might be fun to actually try like skiing with a piece of their outerwear versus just a sweater. You know, I've had their guide sweater for some time, and it's of course a lovely sweater, as it should be. And today I got a chance to, you know, run a morning of relatively chilly skiing in their patrol parka.
Yeah,
it's that like kind of perfect mix of like a classic outerwear jacket but also a ski ready thing.
Right.
And I think it's easy to look at some of their stuff and kind of be like, well, this is more fashion than ski ready. But this thing worked really well. It was really cold on the lift this morning, and I was very warm. I had you know, the Alps sweater underneath. And I had a couple of decent wipeouts, and I didn't end up with snow all the way up my sleeve. I didn't end up with snow all the way up my back. I had pockets for my gloves and my sunglasses.
Yeah.
And it's what I really like about it is it looks just like you want this sort of jacket to look. It's this kind of like very down key navy blue, very simple pockets, no like high key embellishments, nothing that, because a lot of like ski apparel is like,
yeah, it looks very technical,
super technical, or maybe they nail the color. They go like in a Patagonia direction with the color, but then it's covered in a weird logo or a weird design.
Right. And right.
I'm not saying it's wrong or like you shouldn't wear something just because it's not my aesthetic, but it's not my aesthetic. I wouldn't want something that looks kind of like graffiti or
right,
whatever.
Right.
And these are like very much kind of like classically minded. And I kind of didn't know how it would work. You know, I've worn it as an outer layer driving around Toronto in the winter, you know, going to the park with my kids in the winter. But to take it out skiing and it wore just like any other piece of like decent shell jacket I've ever owned. It makes perfect sense. It was really comfortable. I had the pockets I needed and I had the, you know, you've got the pass pocket in your arm for the scan at the base of the lift. And then if you're on the run, I had enough hood to go over my helmet. If I was feeling a little bit chilly on the lift, it worked out really well.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think the great thing about these jackets too, I tried out the Alpine Anorak today, which is a similar material to yours. So it's this sort of heavyweight British Millerain waxed cotton. You know, the thing about these products is that they're inspired by and kind of styled after sort of more, I guess you'd call it retro ski gear. But this is technology that was used and loved by, you know, skiers for decades, you know, years ago. And what I liked about the Anorak, I just like the Anorak style. It's so, you know, an Anorak is something that you pull on over your head. And that can be a little challenging. But what Alps & Meters has done is they've put a side zip. It goes about halfway up your torso, so it makes it a little easier to pull on. You zip it shut. There's a drawstring that you can pull tight at the waist. And then it has this really cool sort of crosshatch lacing at the neck with like a chin flap, chin guard, in case, you know, it gets a little chilly on the lift or when you're coming down those first runs of the day. So you can cinch that up. It's got the ski pass pocket on the left forearm for the scanning, as your jacket did. Good Velcro cuffs, big hood over to put over your helmet. And I was toasty in that thing. I had kind of a light base layer on underneath, and kind of a middle layer, just a really light kind of synthetic insulated piece. And I was really pleasant all day long, and I wiped out a lot. And, you know, waxed cotton is, it's making a comeback. And I think a lot of people that have waxed cotton clothing know that it will shed water pretty well. And, you know, I was covered with snow after a couple of those wipeouts, and the jacket did great.
So much of the time when you want a piece of, like, nicely performing gear, you have to make some concessions about how it looks often.
Right.
You have to be okay with the more aggressive, super sporty, shiny, you know, technical materials. And with the Alps & Meters stuff, it's kind of a nice compromise between the two, where you get an aesthetic that works kind of anywhere. Like, you could wear this Anorak almost anywhere.
Yeah.
And same with the patrol jacket. I mean, it just looks like your normal kind of winter jacket, like a classy winter jacket. It's got a nice orange liner for a little bit of that kind of an extra sporty flair. But on the other side of that, you get the technical performance, which works really well for a day of skiing. I don't think this is necessarily something where you want to go conquer 30 days on Aconcagua.
Sure.
But if you want to take it out skiing, you want to go cross country skiing, head out into the woods for a nice hike. I think these are like a really nice middle road, which is nice and stylish and a little bit more reserved and a little bit more classic in its look, but also provides the warmth and the kind of technical attributes that you'd want from outerwear.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. So, you know, thanks a lot to Alps & Meters for sending
over
the products for this trip. And, you know, we really enjoyed using them and we'll continue to do so. Mm-hmm. And thanks for sponsoring the episode. You can check out more information about these products at alpsandmeters.com.
So how about we talk about some watches, more accurately, a watch?
Yeah, I think so. So, you know, the way Oris does the trip, as James sort of touched on earlier, is, you know, we ski in the morning, you know, bright and early start, first chairlift, and then we ski back down to Vail Village, and we go to this really cool restaurant called Almrazi, and it's an Austrian restaurant, so it's a very Alpine feel. We have a nice lunch, and then Rolf and Vijay get up and they introduce the kind of the new watches. There are a few that are embargoed, ones that aren't going to be released until later, maybe even at Basel.
We'll tell you about those when we can.
Yeah, but the one that they showed us was
it's pretty cool.
Kind of knocked it out of the park. I mean, it was really a shocker to me.
Yep, not at all what I was expecting. I kind of thought that we might see, you know, because there was some rumor that we were going to see another Coral Reef edition.
Yeah.
You know, this is a long-standing partnership between Oris and the Coral Restoration Foundation. And so this would be their second LE in partnership with the Coral Restoration Foundation. But It's more than that because they kind of went all out in terms of what the watch itself is.
It's crazy. I mean, you know, this is actually based on one of my favorite watches. Let's just cut to the chase. It's called the Oris Carysfort Reef Limited Edition.
Yep. So it's limited to 50 pieces. It's 43.5 millimeters. It's a GMT Aquis. It's basically the same watch that they announced at Basel last year.
Yeah.
So you have the 24-hour ceramic bezel. This time we're seeing it in black blue. It's a blue kind of iridescent sunburst dial, gold accents on the dial. And what would those gold accents connect with? A full gold case.
Oh,
I was trying to fast.
You're leading me on there. Okay, I was trying to think of some coral related thing.
No, right. So this is Oris's first solid gold dive watch. I believe it might even be their first solid gold sports watch.
Yeah, I was trying to think. Yeah.
So again, it's a 43.5 millimeter Aquis GMT, which is a rad watch and one of my favorite from Basel last year.
Yeah, me too.
You have to keep in mind that we say this a lot when we talk about Doxa and a couple other brands. Aquis sizes. An Aquis at 43.5 millimeters will wear large, but not top to bottom.
Right.
Very short lugs.
Yeah.
And it has this really trick blue leather strap with a rubber coating. And then, of course, a matching 18-karat gold buckle. It's really cool on wrist. When this comes out, you can go back one day on Hodinkee and you'll be able to see the post. It's my wrist and photos that I shot and words by Jason. And it's kind of an interesting structure for supporting the Core Restoration Foundation because it's a 50-piece Ali and they're going to offer a handful of them at auction in direct 100% support of the CRF and their efforts.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, this is an expensive watch, no doubt. This is
very expensive.
It's a $19,000 watch, and I can't think of another Oris that's probably ever been that expensive. But it's a chunk. I mean, it's a chunk of gold. And,
absolutely.
They've only made 50 pieces, and three of those are being given to the CRF, and they get 100% of whatever they make on them, which will likely be, I would hope, more than $19,000. Yep. So that's a good amount of money to give to them, and it's a great cause. But you know, I think for a watch that expensive from a brand like Oris, I think 50 pieces is right.
I think if they went more, it would be confusing, almost like, are we doing gold watches now?
Yeah, right.
To do 50 of something is one thing, maybe, and I think that this feels like thoughtful and purposeful. You know, we've obviously made fun of a couple other solid gold watches. They were vastly more expensive than this.
Yeah.
And vastly more limited, even though this is only 50.
Yeah.
But I think this is a clever way of directly supporting this and giving like-minded collectors a chance at something really kind of buck wild within the Oris space, which is a solid gold dive watch.
Yeah.
It's still 300 meters water resistance. You know, it's a solid 18 karat yellow gold, you know, with the crown, the case back has a cool kind of motif, a design to it. Obviously, sapphire, anti-reflective, and then you get the GMT functionality. This would be a really cool watch to take diving.
Yeah.
This would be a real cool watch to own either way. Jason and I, neither of us are ever going to own this.
Yeah.
But a really, really cool thing, and I think a really interesting way for Oris to kick off 2020 on this speed.
Yeah, totally unexpected.
Absolutely.
When Rolf held up the photo, I was just, my jaw dropped. But you know what I think is neat about this watch is, you know, gold is kind of having a moment. There's a lot gold watches these days, and you've become a fan.
I love it.
But this is definitely not, this is a very Oris take on a gold watch. It doesn't feel rich old guy gold.
No,
or it
not
doesn't
at
feel
all.
Retro gold.
No, it's and a it also modern doesn't feel gold. Like it doesn't feel like a Hublot or
nope.
or an AP. It's just they've taken a format that we already know, an Aquis.
Yeah.
And they've made it in gold. And as much as the like child within me, the gold fiend 5-year old, would love to have seen this with a solid gold Aquis bracelet.
Oh,
we know what that would do to the price. I mean, like I even in my like just jumping into the gold space in the last year, that would make this probably $35,000 watch.
Yeah.
Maybe you could do it for a little bit less than that into the 20s, but I think this makes sense for a really interesting and growingly effective, you know, preservation foundation with the CRF. I think it's going to be a really interesting project, and we have more even just in a few minutes for you on that. Jason, did you get a chance to try it on your own wrist?
I didn't.
Did you have a slightly larger wrist than mine?
Yeah.
I like this 43 millimeter.
I have tried the Aquas. I mean, I remember trying the steel Aquas GMT at Basel, and I adore that watch.
And I'm a huge fan of, you know, the Durmeister Talker is the same case, but in titanium.
Oh, yeah.
You couldn't have two watches that are kind of more different, but also weirdly similar, because the Durmeister Talker is weird because it's weird layout.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's a dive regulator.
Yeah.
I love that watch. I it's probably my favorite Oris like dive watch short of my Hodinkee LE.
Yeah.
This is weirder but cooler. I really like this, and I know that there will be people who are rolling their eyes at like Oris is making a solid gold watch, but like consider their scope, consider what they're trying to do,
right?
And also, like, I definitely have a bias for gold watches. And a gold sport watch is rad. I think the strap is really cool, and conceivably this could fit any other Aquas 43.5 millimeter strap, like the 20 millimeter.
Yeah, true.
Or 24 millimeter width straps. They have kind of a two, like the actual part between the lugs isn't 24, but the width of the lug outer edge is 24, if that's not too confusing to say in audio. But yeah, so this is their main release, the one we can talk about now. We'll have more throughout the year, and of course more as we get to Basel. That's a huge show for Oris, and as it is for so many different brands, and yeah, about $19,000 for a solid gold Aquas GMT. And to offer some context, we thought it would be fun to talk with an expert about the other side of this process, which comes from the Coral Restoration Foundation itself. And luckily on this press trip, we have one Martha Ressler, the Chief Development Officer for the Coral Restoration Foundation. So we're going to cut to a quick interview with Martha. She was kind enough to sit down with Jason to answer a few questions and chat about their work in regrowing coral populations in the Keys. I think it's fascinating. I've heard this presentation at least once before. So, you know, give Martha a few minutes of your time. And I think this explains kind of the other side, where the money from this, $19,000 solid gold Oris will go. I think the two together combine really well.
Yeah, I agree. And then we'll come back on the other side with final notes. All right, so I'm sitting down here with Martha Ressler, who is the Chief Development Officer from the Coral Restoration Foundation. As we mentioned, Martha's in town for our Oris ski event. We had lunch today, and thanks for joining us here. It's
thanks for having
me. A nice opportunity to do a face-to-face interview, especially something so relevant to something we just learned about. You know, just when you came in for the interview, I joked that, you know, you're not wearing the gold watch that is benefiting the CRF, but you mentioned that you have the auction coming up in February, and you know, it's really cool that Oris supports you guys. And you know, James mentioned that he's done an interview in the past with the group from the Great Barrier Reef, and maybe you can tell us a little bit about what the Coral Restoration Foundation does and kind of what your mission is specifically with the Karyesport Reef project.
Sure. So Coral Restoration Foundation is a nonprofit marine organization, and we're really dedicated to restoring reefs, educating individuals about the importance of the ocean, and using the best available science to improve our methodologies and be able to restore the reef faster in the future.
Cool. And I think probably the dumbed down version that sounds terrible, but that people know is, you know, we've seen photos of planted coral. And I think that's probably what people know you guys for. So you have a very hands-on approach. You know, you talk about education, but, you know, you have divers that are out there actually growing and replanting various kinds of coral, yeah?
That's exactly it. Yeah, we're doing active reef restoration. It's the world's largest reef restoration project.
Wow.
So we've been working from Karyesport Reef in the north, which is just off Key Largo, all the way down to Key West in the south.
Oh, wow.
So that's a huge expanse of the Florida Reef Tract.
Yeah, okay. And specifically, you've done work with staghorn coral and elkhorn coral, and now you're moving on to a new kind?
Well, not moving on, adding to.
Adding to.
So we're still working with the staghorn and the elkhorn, and we're now outplanting two different species of boulder coral as well.
Okay. So you must have a real science element, some biologists or specialists in coral growth that are working.
We've got a great science team. Yeah. And on all told in our nurseries, we actually have 11 species.
Oh, wow.
So we're not outplanting everything. Some of the species we simply have in our genetic arc, and we're protecting them for the future.
Okay. What has caused the degradation? Maybe you can talk a little bit about the degradation to the coral reef. And I was surprised to learn in your presentation at lunch how vast the reef system is there? The Florida Reef is, what did you say, the third largest in the world?
It's the third largest barrier reef in the world, and it's the only barrier reef in the United States. Wow. So it's a really significant reef, but it's not one we hear about all the time.
Yeah, so you know, at lunch you mentioned a few things about the reef system there, and it's amazing to hear how vast it is. But what are the challenges? I mean, besides sort of global warming and ocean acidification and kind of the ocean temperature going up, what about some other more local challenges to the reef? What has caused this kind of the die-off of coral in the Keys?
So the die-off of the coral in the Keys essentially started over 40 years ago. Hmm. So what we're hearing about now happening on the Great Barrier Reef happened in Florida 40 years ago.
Okay.
So, and it really was the result of a number of different local threats. So water quality, nutrification, sedimentation, poor boating practices.
Sure.
And the loss of our sea urchins was a big one too.
Oh, okay.
They're herbivores and keep the algae in check.
Yeah, right.
So all of those combined really didn't do the reefs any favors.
Yeah, okay. And, you know, when it comes to, you know, what Orus is doing with this limited edition watch, as we mentioned, you know, three of those watches are going to be given to the CRF, and all proceeds will then benefit your organization, and presumably you'll put that towards further research and the work you're doing, yeah?
We will have one of the watches at our own Raise the Reef Gala on April 18th.
Okay.
And then we're actually gifting two of the watches to organizations that we work really closely with.
Oh, okay.
So one of those, it will take place in February, as you mentioned earlier.
Okay. All right. Great. And you guys are based in Key Largo?
We're headquartered in Key Largo, yes.
Yeah. And so your focus, I know that earlier you and I were discussing that there are other coral restoration projects going on maybe around the Caribbean that you've had some involvement with in the past, but your main focus now is the Keys. Is that correct?
We're actively working in the Keys. We did help get a number of projects going in the Caribbean, and they're very self-sufficient these days.
That's great.
We still do a lot of training of different groups coming in to learn from us.
Yeah.
And we're part of the Coral Restoration Consortium, which is a wonderful group we helped co-found, and there's over 800 groups doing reef restoration around the world that belong to this group.
Okay. You know, when it comes to growing coral, coral seems like something that has a very long, not gestation period, but a very long growth cycle. Can you tell us a little bit about how long it takes? I mean, how do you start? You clip off existing bits of coral and then you sort of nurture it, or how does that work?
Initially, we did some wild collecting of fragments of opportunity, mm-hmm. where we were able to collect staghorn and elkhorn and other species from around the Florida Reef Tract, the corals that have made it this far.
Mm-hmm.
We brought those corals into our nursery probably over 10 years ago. And at this point, we're able to propagate those corals using our coral trees. So for staghorn, we're able to take a fragment of coral the size of your index finger and grow it to maybe a small dinner plate or a basketball in about 9 to 12 months.
Oh, okay. So that's not too long. I mean, that's surprising, actually. You know,
staghorn
and
elkhorn.
You could almost time-lapse it and watch it grow.
You almost could. I mean, these are faster growing,
the
branching coral species. You know, when we're talking about boulder coral, it's a much longer period to grow them.
Yeah, and boulder coral, I was Googling this earlier, that's a number of different species. So you get like the big brain corals and things like that. Is that considered?
Exactly. We're working with a couple of species of star coral at the moment.
Okay. So you grow them, where is the nursery that you have? Is it on shore, like in your lab, or is it actually somewhere just offshore?
All of our work is done out in the open ocean.
Okay.
So we have seven coral nurseries spanning the Florida Keys, the largest of which is off of Tavernier. And it's about an acre and a half.
Wow.
Yes. Wow. So over 500 coral trees with over 322 genotypes.
Okay. So, you know, when I've been diving in the Keys and some other places where they're doing this type of work, by trees, you mean there are these man-made sort of racks, for lack of a better word, that the coral is kind of placed on, and it's just getting its nutrition from the ocean and sort of growing in place there?
That's almost precisely it. Their trees are made out of fiberglass and PVC.
Hmm.
So, you know, materials you can find almost anywhere.
Yeah.
And we use a duckbill anchor, and then the trees hover in the midwater column.
Huh.
So they're getting nutrients, they're getting sunlight, and there's really no predation. So they're able to put all their energy into growing.
Oh, cool. And then the replanting. How is that done? Is it some sort of an adhesive, or is there more a mechanical process with fasteners of some sort?
At the moment, we use an epoxy. So when the corals are reef-ready size, we cut them down from the trees, tag them so we know exactly what genotype we're working with, and then they're taken to the reef, where divers then use a two-part marine epoxy to attach it right to the reef. And it looks completely natural because the epoxy grows over it in a matter of months.
Yeah, right. That's amazing. Wow. Very cool. And then the bigger boulder crawler, I'm guessing epoxy won't work for something big.
We still use epoxy, but there's drills involved. It's a little bit more complicated when we're talking about the boulder corals.
Yeah, right. So that's great. And how long has the CRF been around, roughly?
We were established in 2007.
Oh, okay. So in the Florida Keys, what results have you seen since that time? I mean, is it a very noticeable difference? You showed us some photos of kind of before and after, and it was very impressive. But maybe you can describe a little bit of the square footage. Or threw out an acreage number earlier that was quite amazing, actually.
So since 2012, we've been able to release over 100,000 corals back to the wild. And that number is continuing to grow. I mean, our divers are out there every day. The weather is nice. We did 50,000 of those corals just in the last 3 years.
Wow. Oh, that's incredible.
So all told to date, it's an area of about 8,000 square meters that we've restored.
Cool.
But the vision's much bigger for the future.
Is that open to recreational divers if somebody was going to the Keys? They'd be able to see this?
Absolutely. We offer dive programs through shops in the Keys. I know in February we have at least 5 coming up. So several times a month people can sign up and come out with us for a day, 2 days. And help restore threatened species to the reef.
Oh, that's fascinating. That's really cool. I'd love to, next time I'm diving down there, I'll look out for that. Maybe I'll get in touch and we'll go out and do a dive and check that out. So, well, I really appreciate your stopping by to chat with us about CRF and the relationship with Oris and kind of the great work you guys are doing. And thanks, Martha, for joining us on TGN.
Thanks for having me.
All right, and we're back. A big thank you to Martha and the entire Coral Restoration Foundation for their work and for taking some time to chat with us. What a fascinating project, eh?
Yeah, really great stuff. And it was nice to have Martha here in town with us and also able to sit down and chat with me for about 10 or 15 minutes here.
You know, it's funny, one of the first interviews we ever did for TGN was actually also with an ocean preservation group via Oris, and that was the Australian Marine Conservation Society in a very early episode. And it's fun to be able to talk to these people directly. These people are like literally doing the handiwork to help to rebuild some of these populations, that have been decimated like into the 90th percentile. I think it's really cool that they support that at both a high level and then at a hands-on level. And it was fun to be able to pick Martha's brain for a few minutes. What do you say we dip into final notes, put a bow on it?
Yeah, let's do it. So I'll go first here. I stumbled upon this book. Actually, my dad gave it to me. I think he bought it at a used bookstore or something, and he knew that I was into this sort of thing. The book is called Where Divers Dare, The Hunt for the Last U-Boat by Randall Pfeffer. You know, we've talked at length in the past about Shadow Divers. Great book, one of our sort of on the TGN library, if we ever have one.
Absolutely.
Which was about a couple of divers that were mildly obsessed, or not even mildly, but obsessed with finding this U-boat that was sunk off the eastern seaboard of the United States. And they had to do a ton of research to kind of track down its last known location and dive it. And it was very deep and dangerous. Anyway, this book is kind of a great follow-on to that because it's about a similar adventure, and it was a small team of divers that set out to find the remains of the U-550, which was another U-boat that sunk an American merchant oil tanker that was on convoy headed to the UK in 1942 during World War II. And the U-boat sunk this tanker, the SS Pan Pennsylvania, and then there was a escort of destroyers that set out to find this U-boat, and they dropped depth charges on it and ultimately sunk the U-boat. And the oil tanker that was torpedoed, the wreck of that has been found, but never the U-boat. And so this was just a few years ago, I want to say 2012, 2013 time. These guys found the U-boat after much searching and research, and then set out to do this dive. And, you know, the obvious comparison here is to Shadow Divers. I would say it is very similar in content. It's been a while since I've read Shadow Divers, but I almost say that this one is as good, maybe a little more dryly written, if you know, that might be fair to say. But definitely check it out. If you liked Shadow Divers, if you like that kind of dive exploration, you know, wreck kind of theme, great book, check it out. I will put a link to the book on Amazon, which is where it's still available. So yeah, check that out.
Very cool. Any book that is as good as Shadow Divers, I need to read ASAP. That's a great recommendation. Mine is actually a story that Jason sent me, and then within the next day or two, probably five or six more of you listening sent to me either via our thegraynato@gmail.com or as an Instagram DM. And it's this story from Outside Online, which is called My Journey to Scotland's Most Remote Pub. It's written by Oliver Smith, a fantastic contributor. And it's the story of the Old Forge, which is the UK's most remote pub and the kind of route you have to take to get there. And it's literally just in the middle of nowhere. There's like not a better way of dealing with it. It's a 27 mile walk if you'd like to get to it.
Takes 3 days.
Yeah, it takes some time. It's a pretty serious thing. And there's not a ton more to say about this. I would just like you to read this. This is something I would very much like to do someday. I think that sounds like a fun.
I mean, can you imagine hiking for 3 days to go for a beer?
talk about earning that pint.
Yeah,
right. For sure.
Right. And, yeah, we think skiing was tough.
Yeah, and it's a really great story. There's some fantastic photography of the Scottish countryside and some good kind of anecdotes, and it kind of gives you the rundown of not only the pub but the route and some people who go there, like who made the hike itself.
Yeah.
And it's just a nice piece of storytelling. This is exactly the type of stuff that I love from Outside Online. It's not unlike that book Out There,
right,
which was a collection of adventure failures, if you will, non-adventures, where things went wrong or bad or otherwise. And I think this could be in a book which is more maybe classic adventuring or I don't know, just kind of like you could kind of do this. The barrier to entry feels kind of low. It's not that dangerous.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Go for a very long walk in Scotland to have a beer and then conceivably walk back.
Yeah.
So that's the Old Forge. Again, the post, because we try and sum these up at the end, is My Journey to Scotland's Most Remote Pub from Outside Online. And Jason's is a book, Where Divers Dare, The Hunt for the Last U-Boat by Randall Peffer.
Well, as always, thanks so much for listening, and big thanks to Alps and Meters for supporting the show. Be sure to check out alpsandmeters.com to get more information about their entire line. Hit the show notes via hodinkee.com or the feed for more details. And you can follow us on Instagram. I'm at Jason Heaton. James is at J.E. Stacey. And follow the show at The Grey NATO. If you have any questions for us, please write thegreynato@gmail.com. And please subscribe and review wherever you find your podcasts. Music throughout is Siesta by Jazzar via the Free Music Archive.
And we leave you with this quote from William James, who said, "We are like islands in the sea, separate on the surface, but connected in the deep."